The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. It occurred to me this afternoon to talk for a while on the theme of trust. And the reason for it is that trust is a very important, has been, it is a very important aspect of my life, or my Dharma, certainly my Dharma practice. Out of my Dharma practice, my Buddhist practice, has come to what I would say a very profound understanding or feeling of trust, which very much is at the foundation of my life, very important for me. So that's what I thought talking about. But I didn't really think, that was one thing to think of a theme. It was another thing to have something to say. So since the theme was trust, I thought I should just trust what would come here. There is a wonderful term, I think it was coined by Gregory Kramer, called trust emergence. Trust what emerges. When I was first practicing in Zen, the idea was to be yourself. And for people who are Dharma teachers and giving talks like this, the idea is just to be yourself. And that was really supposed to be the teaching. Not in the words and the explanations and the lists and the things you could actually say. Not to discount the importance of what's being said. So, I didn't always trust. I think I had a certain degree of mistrust. And probably the biggest mistrust I had was in myself. Mistrusting my ability to engage in the world, mistrusting my ability to be in relationship with other people, mistrusting my competence in the world or something. And one of the most formative experiences of my adult life was starting to meditate. And I started meditating when I was a young adult. And a big part of that experience of meditation was not doing anything, not meditating per se, but rather it was sitting still, upright, in the midst of whatever was happening for me. So if I was, you know, something happened that day and I came from meditation and I was upset or happy, the practice was to sit still and upright with that. If I was agitated, I would sit upright and still with the agitation. If I felt afraid, I would sit upright still with the fear. If I was sleepy, I would do my best to sit upright and still. And still and not move, just to be there with it. And I think this the idea of just sitting still upright with the experience, whatever was going on, was the kind of the primary practice I had when I first started practicing meditation practice. And I think for a long time, sometimes I get caught by what was happening. I'd certainly be with it, but I'd get caught by what was happening. I would be swept away and pushed around by the different feelings and attitudes and thoughts that I had. But over and over again, the practice was you show up, be still and sit upright. And what I slowly learned is to trust being present for my experience. Being present for my experience in the context of being still and upright and being with the experience. So it wasn't pushing it away or denying it. It wasn't like not paying attention to it. It was being with the experience, whatever was going on. And then, but being still and upright. Still means Don't act on it, don't give into it, don't get pushed around by it, don't collapse and have self-pity, just to be still, you know, physically still, nothing else. And upright meant physically upright. That's the way meditation was practiced in Zen. But it also had a kind of, I guess, metaphorical meaning to be upright. We say someone's an upright person, an upright citizen or something. It means they have a certain integrity and are contributing, maybe member of society, and they're honest. And so to sit upright, a certain kind of dignity, certain kind of not being pushed around, not being dependent on others or dependent on things, but also not kind of being diminished by anything, just there in a way. And so over and over again, I did this, and over and over again, as I did it, what I discovered by doing it over and over again was I discovered to trust being present in this way. To trust, not necessarily what was happening. What was happening in and of itself doesn't make sense to say I trusted it necessarily. But I trusted what would occur as I stayed present. I trusted how it evolved, how it unfolded. How it moved through me, how it resolved, how it relaxed, that somehow that it, it was manageable, it was okay. I survived. It wasn't so bad. There's many different angles. I learned that it was okay to stay present. In my early years of Zen, I learned to do it with physical pain. I had a tremendous amount of physical pain when I meditated. And I had all kinds of reactions to it, all kinds of self-judgments about sitting there and my inability. And it was, I had a very complicated relationship. It wasn't like easy. But slowly, as I kept sitting with pain, I learned that it was possible for me to sit with pain. And that it was okay. As long as I wasn't damaging myself. And that was a huge lesson for me. It wasn't a lesson I'd learned growing up. The lesson, if anything, I learned growing up was to fix pain as fast as possible. But rather what I learned was that it's possible to sit still, upright with the pain and not be overwhelmed by it, not be pushed around by it, not have self-pity for it, not be afraid of it. And it was quite a remarkable thing that I started to learn to do this. And I can remember at some point I started to take that lesson of sitting with physical pain into my daily life. And even though I was moving, walking around and doing things, the idea of the mind at least being still and unmoving, still and present with the experience, still and upright, became kind of the kind of thing, let's discover how to do this. How do I do this in this situation? So for me, you know, the early was pain, but it was also emotional pain. I had, certainly a lot of emotional pain. And there also, I got pushed around by it, I believed it, I got tripped up by it, I tried to avoid it, I tried to, all kinds, you can imagine the games the mind plays, right? Emotional pain. Maybe some of you had some hints of it. And I would, when you sit and meditate every day you show up, sit upright and be still, it works itself out, or you find a way, or you work yourself out, or I found myself how to be present. And I learned kind of, it's kind of like if there's a square rock in the riverbed, over time its edges get worn out and it becomes round. If you keep showing up to sit upright and be still in the middle of your experience, the rough edges you have, your attachments, your fears, your reactions, will begin rounding and softening and relaxing, and you'll become rounder. You won't be so square anymore. And rounder in a good way, in a nice way. I think of, round and whole. And what was remarkable to me was, this didn't require, advanced studies of meditation techniques, the neurobiology of the mind, the degree in psychology. It elaborate practices of how to address and deal with things. It was really a very simple thing. Show up, be still, be upright, and let it move through you. Let it see what happens. So, two things. So, one thing I learned not to be so reactive. I learned that it was okay to be present, that I didn't have to fix everything, I didn't have to run away from anything, I can just be present. So I learned to trust being present. And that was really profound. So profound that I think one of my first Vipassana Dharma talks that I ever gave when I started being a teacher was a talk I gave on trust. I said I learned that if you're mindful of your experience, you can trust the experience. And the reason I said that is that being mindful of it means that you have this upright stillness where you really see it for what it is. And then if you really see it and you have this non-reactive way, you're not caught in the experience, not pushed around by it, you'll find the wisdom. You'll find how to react and how to respond. And maybe sometimes it's hard to do that in daily life where things are complicated, but it's a really remarkable thing, amazing thing, to discover how to do this in meditation. And part of why it's amazing about meditation is a time where you don't have to solve anything. You don't have to fix anything in meditation. How often in your life do you have that kind of quality time to be present and nothing has to happen? You don't have to answer an email. You don't have to check. You hear the ping. You don't have to do anything about it. Check the email. You don't have to, if the house is burning, you should probably do something. But often most of our life is about doing things and arranging things and getting pleasure and taking care of things or whatever. In meditation, you don't have to respond to anything. You don't have to react to anything. You don't have to fix anything. And to do this over and over and over again, show up in a situation where you don't have to do anything about it, you don't have to fix it, is a remarkable thing. Provided your meditation is about not fixing anything. Some people's meditation is all about attaining something, getting concentrated, getting some still, stopping the mind from thinking. And those kinds of meditation practices are certainly valid and useful at times. But my early years of meditation practice, that was not the route I took. And I was very happy with this looking back because I learned something I think was much more important than learning a technique to get concentrated. I learned to trust being present from my experience. And to learn to trust it in such a way that I could stop the reactivity and not get caught in the reactivity of my mind. Make some sense? And then I learned something else about trust. I learned that I learned that it was okay to be present for experience. But then I learned that if I was really honest with the experience, honest with the situation, that there is something about the dynamic of situation that tends to unfold in a healthy way in the context of that honesty, that recognition. So, and that when it's in meditation, where it's such a great place to be with it, if you're honest, which is another way of saying being mindful, if you're really mindful and honest of what's going on here and present for it, and really see what's happening here, then whatever is going on is part of a process, and the process can unfold cleanly or nicely if you're honest about what's happening. So if you're angry, if you're in a funk, if you just really honestly say, this is what I'm happening, I'm angry and in a funk, without any extra baggage, without all the square parts of you that react and poke and push and run away. But just there, that gives the opportunity for that movement of anger, the process of anger, to unfold in the way it needs to unfold. If you're afraid, the same thing. If you're caught up in egomaniacal tendencies, and you're really honest about it, it might be hard not to feel embarrassed, hard not to feel justified, hard not to feel like you're bad and wrong. But when we do this kind of show up and be present, nothing is seen as wrong. And nothing is kind of like nothing's also seen as right. It's just seen as what's unfolding. And so the anger, in the context of sitting still in meditation, being honest about it and let it move through you, something begins to shift and change. And if you give yourself enough time for that, I found that the deeper wellsprings from that anger is coming, where that sadness is coming from, where the joy is coming from, is a meaningful place. That is a deeper wellspring of intelligence, of wisdom, of sensitivity, of tenderness, of, I'm a little bit reluctant to say it this way, but wellsprings of goodness inside of us. And so I learned that even the things that conventionally people criticize as being wrong and bad, you're not supposed to be this way, that it's not necessary to have that kind of attitude. It's not necessary to be critical of any way that we are if you can sit still and upright and honest about it. Just stay and learn to kind of, you know, if you can, you might have to kind of erode some of the edges that keep poking at things and yourself and the reactivity and judgments you have about it that shouldn't be this way, tendencies to fix or whatever. But as we learn to let go of all the secondary reactions to it, that no matter how awful what's going on inside of you might be, that chances are really good that if you could just do this process, this deep process of letting go, of sitting with it, that it unfolds, it resolves, it unfolds into deeper and deeper areas of ourselves. And one of these reasons is something I think is now recognized by many people, psychologists and people, is that some of our attitudes, some of our feelings, some of our things we're trying to do belong to layers in the psyche and the mind. And so, there are people some people specialize in being judgmental, being critical of others. That's kind of like their calling card. It's what they like to do. I don't know if they like to do it, but what they do. Sometimes people come and talk to me and say, I have this issue, I'm so judgmental, and everywhere I go I'm judging people. And it's a real problem. And one of the nice questions to ask them then is to ask, and it usually throws them off for a moment if I ask this question. The question is, what benefit do you get from being judgmental? And then they say, what benefit? I'm just a bad person. You're not supposed to do this. This is not a good thing. No, I said, please stay with it. I understand that it might be kind of not so nice to do, but how might it be benefiting you to do it? And one of the answers that people sometimes will give is that it's a way of protecting themselves. Because if they can judge someone else, it deflects them from themselves. It's a kind of a comparison then between they're doing it wrong, therefore, of course, since I'm the one who knows they're doing wrong, guess what it says about me? I know better, I'm good. So it's a way of kind of bolstering a self-image, protecting oneself. If that's the case, and then I say, what does that come from? This desire to protect yourself, what does that arise out of? And then sometimes people say it arises out of fear. And then I say, well, what does the fear arise out of? And they take a while, maybe sometimes they're present for that and they feel it. The fear comes out of a desire to be safe. And then then sometimes I stop there and say, well, that's a wonderful thing to want to be safe. It's a reasonable. And so what about if you stay there? And maybe if you realize that you have a desire to be safe, now you can reconsider, and what are useful ways of doing that? Are there better ways of doing it than judging everyone? And some people find that kind of digging down the layers and coming down to something deeper, they find it meaningful. But what I find is that by going down into the deeper layers, we come to a place where there's kind of goodness there, a basic humanity that's fine. So rather than thinking that we're bad or wrong for anything at all, if you have something that you, some tendency that feels uncomfortable or painful or dysfunctional, conventionally bad, other people would say that maybe about you, it's not really helpful for this process of healing, this process of resolution, this process of freeing yourself to look upon your self negatively. But it is helpful to be honest and present and still with the experience. And then it begins to relax, unfold, resolve into these deeper layers until it comes to a deeper layer where there's this deeper sensitivity, this deeper goodness that's there, deeper, a place of freedom that's there. And so this trusting of experience, I've seen this over and over again myself, so that so again, that if I can be mindful and honest about my experience and be present for it, that it's trustable, it's workable, it's okay. And so I don't have to go around expending the effort. I mean, I'm saying it maybe as if it's easy, but I don't have to go around extending the effort to be self-critical, to think that I'm kind of, on principle, a lousy person. And when I was younger, it was kind of the basic structure of the universe was built in such a way that I was a lousy person. I mean, that was just like a done deal, right? Somehow that's what the universe had figured out. And that was the truth. It felt so ingrained that this is the way it was. But just sitting there and being present and being with the experience and being honest and mindful, that began to break up and soften. And I saw that it's not needed to that kind of judgments. So then trusting that process of going in, trusting that in the depth of who I am, depth of who we are, there's no need then to get caught up in these, you know, negative judgments about ourselves. Then another thing about trust I learned, and that is that also it's possible to trust what emerges, to trust what arises in the mind. So I've learned to show up in situations over and over again where I didn't know what to do. And that can be scary, not to know what to do. It's scarier to close down. It might not feel scary, but the risks are greater if you close down. But if you stay willing to address the unknown, and then also there, like in meditation, to sit and be still and upright in the midst of the unknown is really a remarkable thing. And for me, this is something that I experience mostly on retreat, not in daily meditation practice, but in long periods of meditation, many hours a day, a very dramatic feeling of being kind of the edge of the unknown, the edge of the unknown of who am I if I'm not holding on to a self-image, not trying to be someone, not seen through other people's eyes, not measuring myself by other people. The edge of the unknown if I don't organize my life by my thoughts and my ideas and concepts of how things should be. And it can be quite scary to be on that edge. But to trust that it's, you know, again, over and over again, to be on that edge and to trust, eventually learn it's okay to sit there present in the face of the unknown. We don't have to know. And, you know, it seems to me odd, maybe some people haven't done a lot of meditation, you know, it seems like meditation should feel, you know, you close your eyes maybe and you sit quietly and still and it seems like it should be a comfortable place. But sometimes in that space of meditation, it puts us up against some of the scariest places in life. Partly because we're up against the unknown. And so to sit there and be upright and still, even in the face of the unknown, find out that that's manageable too. That's okay too. That worked itself out too. And so then having this ability to be there in the unknown, not know, and then to show up for difficult situations in life. Conversations we have to have with other people, for example, or conflicts and challenges we have, or many situations that we find ourselves in, and be willing and find that we don't have to plan ahead. We don't have to have a conversation ahead over and over again, figuring out what we're going to do. But rather, something emerges in the situation. Something arises from in. So what I've learned is that there are situations where there's a deeper knowing, deeper understanding deeper response to the situation that's better than anything I could have figured out on my own. Isn't that great? Luckily, it's the case. And so this trusting the emergence, trusting the arising of knowing, understanding, a responsiveness, an intuition, tuning in to the situation that is not, does not belong to only my thinking mind, is also a very important part of this trust. So it's not just a matter of trusting being present, it's also then trusting what arises. It doesn't mean I blurt out whatever I want to say, but I've learned to listen to this deeper voice, this deeper knowing that's there, and trust that I can show up in situations and not know and see what arises, what happens. And sometimes part of that trust is I don't even know what the consequences are sometimes of what I'm going to say, what I'm going to do, but somehow there's a trust that somehow, if we're honest, if we're present, we'll find our way. And I've been in plenty of situations where I didn't know what was going on, didn't understand what to do, and that was one of the things I would say, part of the honesty, I don't know what's going to happen here, but let me offer you some feeling I have, or some perspective I have, or something, and then offering, and then somehow the honesty of two people or more people, there's a process that goes on, and over again I found that we find our way. So this idea of trusting the emergence, trusting the response that we have to the situation, is one of the things that maybe doesn't come naturally, just automatically, but for me, it comes from the long years of meditation that I've done, I feel. Showing up, being still, being upright, and being with the experience, listening to the experience, learning to listen more deeply, and not being afraid, being willing to be in the unknown and allow something to arise and to be there. In my early years of Buddhist practice was in Zen, and one of the very nice things that they taught in Zen was could be summarized in a little complaint that there's a very famous scholar, Buddhist scholar, teacher named Robert Thurman, and he's fond of complaining about Buddhists. He's like one of the most true blue Buddhists around, the card-carrying Buddhists around. But his complaint is that these Buddhists, all they ever talk about is practice, 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 practice. When's the performance? So in Zen, they have this idea that it's not just about letting go. It's not just about learning how to be still and peaceful. The real practice occurs in how you respond to the life, the performance. And so how you meet the situation is important. And sometimes I do see Buddhists who, their response to difficulty is they withdraw, and they're good, maybe good meditators, sit and meditate and cool down, and then they never go back to the situation and deal with it. You know, so they've cooled themselves down. That's nice for them, but there's not much life in that. And so the idea of the performance, the idea that practice also has to do with, you know, meeting the world and encountering the world and how we respond and are in it, the performance, we practice and we perform. And the performance is trusting the emergence also, can be. Where does it come from? Where does the emergence come from? Where does this deeper knowing come from? Do we trust that? And so I'll end with I invented a Pali term, an ancient Buddhist term, right? This ancient language, you know. I know just enough to make up a new phrase. So hopefully you'll go along with it. I'll tell you the Pali and then I'll translate it. Dhamma Citta Upada Kanti. The way I'd like to translate it into English is trusting the arising of the Dharma mind, the mind of the Dharma, or the mind of truth. So trusting the arising of the mind of Dharma. So not the mind of anger, not the mind of fear, not the mind of desire and wanting, but there's a mind of Dharma, mind of truth, the mind that's settled, the mind that's integral, the mind that's whole, the mind that comes from the depth of who we are, the mind of truth. And to trust that, to trust the arising of that, so that how we perform, how we act, how we respond in the world can come from this really good place. So in these different ways, trust has been a very important theme for me in my years of practice. And I keep coming back to this idea for me, that trust. I don't know if this is the term or the concept or the attitude or the feeling that is right for everybody. There are other important touchstones, reference points for how people's Dharma practice unfolds and develops. And but this was important for me. So I offer that to you. And we have in our schedule 10 minutes left. So now's your chance. If you have questions or concerns or testimonials about trust, you have some understanding of your own about trust that you want to share, it'd be nice to hear. Can you? If you could say your name as well, I think I'd like. It'd be nice to have a custom here, if you're willing.
My name is Wendy. Is this on? I am just curious about what the process was with the pain that you were feeling. Did that just eventually go away?
The pain.
The pain. You said you sat with physical pain for a long time.
Yeah, comes and goes. I mean, in the Zen, it's all kinds of pains, but the most common was the knee pain. And I still have knee pain sometimes. I don't mind so much anymore. It comes and goes. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not there. But it was pretty dramatic back then. And so a number of things happened. You know, a little bit of it was new to meditation, and you know, I think the tendons and ligaments stretched, you know, so that helped a lot with time. But also I learned not to be so reactive to it. I'd get angry at myself. I'd have a lot of self-pity. I'd be steeling myself against it, bracing myself against it. And I slowly learned that all the ways I reacted to it made it worse. And so I learned that I'm better off leaving it alone rather than reacting to it. And that helped a lot as well. I also learned that being very attentive to it, really tuning into it, being very present for it, also changed my relationship to it. It changed the experience. And so I learned also the value sometimes of going really close in. I learned that if I stayed at a distance from the pain, that it was too easy, almost subconsciously or unconsciously, to be, even in the awareness of the pain itself, there would be some attitude of resistance or fear or something. But if I really brought myself really close in to feel it, then that fear resistance would kind of somehow melt away and I could be there in a cleaner way. So it's a whole adventure. Pain is adventure. It's a long, big adventure, and lifetime adventure, and you have to learn new lessons at different junctures in that lesson and how it works. But it's a great teacher. I don't recommend you go out looking for pain or making yourself hurt so you can use that as a teacher. That's not a good idea. But if pain happens to come your way someday, I think it's also a wonderful teacher that it's possible to really go deep with the pain. And I've known some really great practitioners who've had extremely difficult chronic pain who have learned how to use mindfulness to be present for it in such a way that it was manageable, it was workable, they could live their life. So I don't know if that addressed your concern well enough. Okay.
Can you make sure that the green light is on?
The green light, is the green light on? There's a little button in the middle of the handle, middle of the...
Yes. My name is Tom.
Okay, a little bit higher, too.
Is it? A little closer to my
mouth. Yeah, wait, I don't think it's on, is it? Is the green light on? But then maybe the battery is low.
Well, there is a green light on.
Yeah, sometimes the battery goes out. So let's get you another one.
This is an area that I'm just getting into in trust. So I may not understand what I'm saying or fully believe it, but it seems to me that learning to trust myself is somehow very tied into learning to trust other people.
Mm.
If I think other people are unworthy or evil, that it is very hard for me to quiet myself and feel trusty in the situation I'm in.
Right.
Does that make any sense to you, and do you have any comments on it?
You're giving me a blank check to comment whatever way I want?
Yes?
Yes? Yes. There's risk then for you.
I trust you.
Yeah? I think there's a lot of wisdom to what you say, that the importance of learning to trust yourself. If you trust yourself more, it's easier to trust other people. But to start off by saying, not everyone should be trusted conventionally. You know, there are people who will take advantage of you for sure, give them half a chance. So, you know, it has to be a little bit more sophisticated what it means to trust, you know, trust other people. You have to have your street smarts also. You know, trust God, but tie your camel to the post, they say, right? But the reason I asked about the blank check is that, so I want to first kind of say, yes, it's great what you're saying. I encourage you to explore that and develop that. It's really good. But what I'd like to suggest to you, that the trust I'm talking about does not involve trusting yourself and does not involve trusting others. Because too much focus on trusting yourself is a dead end. That concept, the idea of trusting yourself, though it kind of makes sense, but it's a dead end because sooner or later, chances are you're going to run into what you think the self is, your identity of what you think it is, and self and other kind of, even the idea of self and other is kind of an identity issue, is kind of an idea and concept. And then you're reinforcing this idea, the identity. So that's why I think it's, we're trusting something different. We're trusting, so the things I talked about, we're trusting being present, we're trusting honesty, we're trusting being mindful, we're trusting paying attention, and we're trusting the heart's ability to arise, the ability to respond to the world from a deep place within. Now, a person might say, "Well, that's what I mean by self," you know, which is fine. But I think it's actually easier to discover this deep thing if we challenge ourselves a little bit and don't try to trust ourselves, but to trust something even deeper, something more profound. And, you know, perhaps, I don't know, one of the great scientists of the 1800s, great physicists, who said, "Something inside of me which is not myself discovered this laws of thermodynamics." You know, he wasn't taking credit, but he wasn't saying it came from someone else. I mean, it came from this psychophysical being. But when we say self, you know, I discovered it, it's a small self, it's a small idea, the concepts and ideas. So to get out of the way of that and trust the emergence of something, trust what emerges out of the unknown, not even have to trust yourself because you trust something even deeper. And then you don't have to trust your neighbors either. But you don't have to be afraid of them. You don't have to be suspicious of them. That's also not necessary. But you can be wise. You can enter the situation with your eyes open and present and tuned in. And in that tuned in, present, alert, open, non-reactive presence with your people, hopefully you'll have the street smarts to know what's the right thing to do. Does that make some sense what I'm saying? Enough sense that it gives you, this gives you enough sense, and enough, am I saying enough that gives you something to be provocative?
Oh, yes.
So you can go home to think about it? Thank you. So this can be the last one. What was your name?
Tom.
Tom and Wendy. And
hi, my name is Nirali. And I'd like you to expand a little bit on what you said about when you sit to meditate, it's a beautiful opportunity to not have to fix anything.
Yes.
And you also mentioned about not cultivating concentration or any of that as important.
It can be important. I don't want to belittle the importance of it, but it's a different practice. It can be a different practice than just being present. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, so my question was, like, if you could expand on what do you mean when you say, like, not having to fix anything or do anything, like, if you could just elaborate a bit on that.
What is there to elaborate on? It's just to be present.
But being present is like cultivating a certain kind of concentration, right?
No, it doesn't have to be. Being present means there's interesting. There's different kinds of presence, different kinds of attention. Awareness can be used in different ways. So we take the capacity for awareness, and it's possible to zero it in on a very narrow field and be very concentrated, like a magnifying glass. It's possible to take awareness and expand it up, and it's very broad and expansive. It's possible to bring awareness to the sense that you're really close and intimate with the experience, like you're touching it almost. It's possible to have awareness be so pulled back that it's almost like you're on the hilltop or across a street looking at yourself, you know, from a really objective, from a distant way. Awareness is very malleable. And it's possible to add different qualities together with awareness. So it's possible to connect capacity for awareness with a very strong, stable mind that's one-pointed and focused on one thing. It's also possible to have awareness connected with an open field of awareness where it allows different experiences to arise and pass at different times. So it depends what kind of practice you do. So the kind of practice I was talking about, it's best not to have too many ideas of what it is. It's mostly a practice of not doing. So when you find yourself trying to do something beyond sitting upright and still and being, stop doing it. So what are some of the things you might notice your mind starts doing?
When I sit?
Yeah.
It thinks, it plans, it goes into past and future, mm-hmm. into likes, dislikes.
And so what do you think would happen if every time that you start doing that, you stop doing it? And just be with what's there, rather than kind of merely going along. That's one way of practicing. It's a very useful way. So the idea of keep showing up and just being with what's there rather than being with the thoughts.
Makes sense.
Okay, so I hope that I haven't confused anyone this evening. And so you might consider a little bit this week your relationship to the concept of trust. I suspect most of us have one either have considered it, or if you haven't considered it, have some kind of automatic feelings or relationship with it, the word. So you might consider what your relationship to trust is, and I offer one last kind of, for your own reflection, to consider the difference between trust and confidence. What's the difference between trust and confidence? One place that I've read makes a distinction that confidence, they say, has more to do with competence. Whereas trust, when you trust someone, you don't trust. If you're confident in someone, you trust their competence. But if you trust someone, you trust their honesty, their integrity, and their goodness more. And so be trustworthy is different than being capable. So what is trust? And what makes you trustworthy? Or what do you trust in? What's your relationship to trust? Great. Thank you.